Welcome to the Creative Play and Podcast Network. Join us as we share our favorite RPGs, one-shot games, tabletop games, reviews, and convention panels. Sit back and enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Kelly, aka Trixie from Ragnarok and Roll, assigned to Ragnarok Story, and Tilda Wimblewick from D&D Journey of the 5th Edition. First off, I would just like to say thank you to everyone for listening to our varied adventures, as well as for rating us on iTunes and RPGpodcast.com. If you haven't rated us yet, we would greatly appreciate it if you could. And if you're looking for more ways to support our efforts, we are now on Patreon, a great site where you can help us continue making more podcasts, as well as some special surprises for our patrons. If you can, please look us up at www.patreon.com/cppn. Every little bit helps. And again, thank you for listening.
At this moment, we tend to record all of our panels live, so they're archived. So if you ever see that we've gone to a convention, you're like, oh, I couldn't go to that convention on Mars. The travel is really prohibitive. We'll live stream it. Now, the delay is going to be really long if we're on some place like Mars, but it's much less worse if we're in, like, Atlanta. It's pretty instantaneous in that case. And then it's archived so you can see it later. Or if you're really delightful humans who come and see us in person and you're like, ooh, that was so nice, and they said some nonsense that seemed like it made sense, but I really want to review because it was a lot of nonsense, you can go review our videos later on our Facebook page. And someday, some of them do make it over to YouTube. But please do not hold me to any schedule, because I'm terrible at that. But it lingers on Facebook for eternity. Hello!
Hello.
We have a few minutes, so this is just the before show pattern. And, yes, Brenda.
Can you make sure that Ravine has the right room? Okay, great.
Thank you. So, how's everyone doing? Don't make me call it on you.
And if you're over here, we just can't see you. It's not your. It's not a you thing. It's a.
Oh, the grand officer can't see you, but I can.
Yeah, it's a real limited perspective type issue. I can't really turn my head.
But
that
if you, but if you're past Lynn on that side, I may or may not see you. Lynn is the outer limits. Hello, Lynn. Did you know you were the outer limits?
Sure.
Excellent. Good. Well, you are encrypted, so why
please
not?
Stand by.
So, for those of you at the back, of course, you should always sit where you're comfortable, but we may not be mic'd because this room is pretty intimate. So if you can't hear, you may wish to move forward.
Probably not that first row, though, because it's like...
That's right, a splash zone. It's very dangerous in that first row. We might drink tea, and then you never know what's going to happen once the tea is unleashed.
That's also why I'm inviting you over here.
Yes, yeah, smart.
You've got to do it that corner. The
smart.
Other splash zone. These ones, splash zone.
Oh, good. The airship ambassador is prepared with a notebook.
To shield the vest with a notebook.
That's protecting yourself from the tea. No! Providing your own shade.
Yes. So this is going to be a little bit different than our other panels. It's going to be more interactive in the sense that it's going to be more a discussion and a sharing of knowledge, and the goal to be sharing our experiences and interests and sort of the feeling for those things.
And our insights. And then if you have questions, there will be time to ask questions. And I see our illustrious
hi.
Arthur Beast.
Hi.
Hello, my darling.
You're not late. You're like British.
My darling, you cannot possibly be late because all things are
happy to see you. Unlike you, Madame Skew and the Grand Arbiter are riddled with a deep need to be overly on time to everything.
Also,
so we're always 15 to 30 minutes early to anything.
Like fools. But also, it's hot outside. I'm happy to see you. Hello, good afternoon. How nice to see you.
So, I guess we'll start by introducing ourselves, because I'm assuming many people know who we are, but let's not presume.
Let's not presume. Does anybody in here not know who we are?
Ah, see?
See?
Liar. Just for the posthumously of the internet, I am the Grand Arbiter. Myself and my partner in crime, Madam Askew, you can tell we are a match set because we match.
It's true.
Our weird queers who perform across the country, and we have been happily performing at WildWestCon for a number of years that is grotesque.
Since the second WildWestCon.
Yes.
We'll let you do the math.
And we are, our expertise is that we are homosexuals, we are slightly overly educated, and we read and watch stuff.
Yeah.
My name is Eve Riot. I am a cohort who works adjacent to Madame Askew, the Grand Arbiter, hence why I am the sun to their rainbow today. I'm a burlesque performer, historian, and all around oddball queer person, and my credentials are the same.
Yes.
And I'm Gail Carriker. I am a steampunk author, also other stuff, but I got my start in steampunk, and that's what I'm best known for, 16 years now. Yeah, I have some bookmarks if anybody hasn't gotten them from other things, you want them. The most exciting one is probably this one for this panel. but it does also have a bunch of books by other authors that I tend to recommend the most. So if you like my books and you want me to recommend books to you, this is the bookmark for you. This one's all my books in world chronological order with colors at the spines. And this is my latest one, which is a very queer sci-fi piece.
It's my favorite ones. It's my favorite ones. They're the best ones. If you haven't read them yet, you're like missing out on like arguably the single most important form of sci-fi queer media I've ever read.
Oh, wow. There you go. I don't even need to hear my own.
It does this interesting
episode. It does. No, it's a very,
it is,
it's meant to be thought provoking.
It's dense. It's,
yes,
it's
chewy.
It's chewy, but very easy to swallow. That's
okay.
What I would say.
Part of your like ethical fibrous diet.
Yes. Yes, it's psyllium powder in literature form.
Well, I don't know how I feel about that, but
I think you should just put that on
the cover.
Are you
going to make everything else easier afterwards?
No. Make everything else easier afterwards. That's the joke. You're there. We got there together.
yeah, so there it is. So I write queer stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'm Madame Askew, the second half to that delightful cheeky strumpet at the end, the Grand Arbiter. As he said, we've been performing all over the place for a long, long time. I'm definitely overeducated. I speak too many languages. I read a lot of books. I also host an incredibly long-running steampunk book club and do regular monthly interviews with authors. And I'm, I guess, sort of a reviewer of books.
No, you are legitimately a reviewer of books.
Yeah, I like to review books, and I've been specializing lately in queer media in the book realm because, really, life is short. Let's be gay, do crimes, and read a lot of books.
That's what I'm doing.
Okay.
I like that white space.
So today we are here for Fabulously Evil.
Woo!
Which is the history of queer-coded villains. We're very excited to bring this to us. When Madison and I read the theme for this year, we're going to leave this open because it's going to block our camera.
Oh, there's a camera?
Yes.
No, you are quite all right.
Thank you. If you go to this side, it's fine. It's just directly
okay,
in front
we'll
of
be able to hear you.
Okay.
As long as you can hear us, but I do like seeing your beautiful faces.
Okay.
So.
No, not to be difficult. We're trying to say these five seats are sort of blocked for camera viewage. So when Madison and I we read the theme, we were thinking about, we've been pushing for doing more edutainment type conversations around tropes and mores, which are parts of like what Madison and I enjoy to talk about. Really, just you get to enjoy the kinds of conversations and debates Madison and the Grand Arbiter have on the regular.
But it's also Eve's fault, and then it's Gail's fault, because Eve,
and also yes. Mom,
is obsessed with queer-coded villains.
I am.
And talks about it with frequency. To sing some of your praises with great eloquence and sort of infected us with also a passion. And then, of course, everything's Gail's fault because you're a brilliant author who's also infected us with joy in your books. And you know a lot about this sort of thing, and we've heard your conversations about heroes and villains and the arts, and so we're like, we want to do this panel. Do you think we can convince Gail and Eve to do it with us?
Yes. Also, it's also very helpful to get us some legitimacy because we look pretty wacky.
So that's the genesis of the panel.
So this is going to be an open discussion panel. The idea is going to be you can participate and raise your hand if you have an idea or you have something you want to talk about as we're discussing. If you're moved, raise your hand. Let us know you have opinions to share because this is really an open experience for us all to share our thoughts and feelings. It's an open thoughts and feelings panel. I'm a thoughts and feelings kind of guy.
Just because I can tell this is the nature of how we're going to go, I'm going to do my connections as well, just
yes.
in case.
Yes, you should.
Which is, apart from the books, I have two master's degrees, one of which is an MS. My undergraduate field of study was classical archaeology, so I had to take a lot of classics and mythology. So my reference point is going to be way far back for queer-coded villainy. So we go way back. And the physical evidence and all that sort of stuff. So yes. Oh, and I wrote.
It's really.
I straight up wrote the book on the heroines.
Yes.
So good.
What's really nice is you have sort of an arc of experience because there, you have like a real, real far back there. Like you're looking way back, and I have some more recent stuff. And Madam's View, and you have some middle ground areas that you have your sort of expertise in.
So we should do good.
We should do good. We should all survive this experience. Okay, so I like to be a little organized, but not. I tried to be less organized with this one. So I'm going to open with a question, and we'll talk about it, and we'll move from there.
Perfect.
And some of it we're going to be providing information, some of it's going to be opinion. We will try to make that clear where possible. Again, we are lovers of media, consumers of media, and we do our best to educate ourselves, but we are not, at least I'm not, an expert, capital E, perfect knowledge source. So if I have some information that's incorrect or a misunderstanding of something historical, please call me out on it. I'm very comfortable with that. But also recognize that we are fallible, and that's all I just want to focus on because I can't make promises that I'm going to be 100% accurate on anything. Our first question that we're going to focus on, and I think it's like the crux of what we're going to be talking about, is why connect villainy and queerness? And I think that is really the crux of big people, lots of younger people's opinions in the last, like your Gen Zs, your Gen Alphas. There's a lot of question about why this connection is happening. And it's very interesting for me as a sort of millennial gay man, because from my perspective, I was like dating during ADDT and all sorts of other forms of like, I'm not directly affected by, but tangentially affected by the AIDS crisis. So Gen Z and Gen Alpha don't have that same kind of experience where it's not exactly the same experience. So there's a real change, and the internet didn't exist when I was growing up as a queer person in the same way it does now. And so it's very interesting that there's a little bit of a pushback that I'm seeing from Gen Z and Gen Alpha sort of against that sort of narrative, the queer villainous villain narrative structure. So that's where I'm starting.
No, that's fine. So my brain immediately wants to define semantic terms. You'll notice whenever I write nonfiction, including on my blog, that I'm like, I'm going to tell you the terms I'm using, like archetype or trope, in the way that I understand them. So
good start.
For that, for me, that means I'm going to talk about queer coding, because mm-hmm. queer coded villainy is what we're talking about here, in the way I understand it. And the way I understand it, there are different kinds of queer coding as we see it in media.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think about, for example, queer coded Disney villains. They often are visually queer coded, are linguistically.
It's the aesthetics.
Yes, but it's also tonality of voice, mm-hmm. like Jafar or something.
I mean, aesthetics is a more wide...
Right, aesthetic, which is interesting existing in a steampunk space, which is an aesthetic movement mm-hmm. primarily. So, like, this is all very... Not that bit of it. But from an archaeological standpoint, that translates to the trappings, usually funerary trappings, that we have for a skeletal structure. So we can look at the biological skeleton, for example, and then see if that person is being queer-coded by their attire or in some way. So that is what it correlates to in the ancient past. But the other thing, the other kind of queer-coding that exists in the historical record is narrative queer-coding, mm-hmm. which is when a character is a female in the narrative, and I'm thinking specifically about somebody like Antigone, but is clearly
of
masculine.
Yes,
of the Oedipus cycle, but it's clearly masculine acting by the conceits of the narrative structure she's operating under. She's operating as a tragic hero. And there are some cases to be made where that is also a Greek commentary on sapphic inclinations. And so you could argue that that's actually being done by a kind of narrative structure, which is employing tropes, but more specifically archetypes.
So a person falling out of an archetype that generally is associated with their gender
exactly.
might be a queer indicator.
Exactly, yeah. As opposed to another tragic heroine like Iphigenia Tauris, who is clearly following the feminine in all ways and is acting in a way that the prevailing patriarchal Greek society would consider appropriate to her particular set of like dramatic circumstances. So both of these women in play.
For quick context, I'm just going to give you a quick rundown of who these two characters are, just because you may not have a background in Greek classics.
Sorry.
Antigone takes actions to ensure her brother's appropriate funeral rites. When he was supposed to be denied them and is killed for it, where Iphigenia is sacrificed to start the Trojan War.
Right. By a man,
which is important.
Yeah.
By her father, specifically.
Right. Although she is encouraged to do so, yeah.
But the framework of those two characters, you can see the sort of... that Antigone is taking the action.
Yeah, they're both doomed women, mm-hmm. but if you analyze the narrative conceits around them, there's a case that Antigone is in fact a lesbian. And then there are Medea and other sort of Circeus, sort of more witchy characters present, which you can argue many different directions. But I just wanted to bring up the concept that queer coding does not necessarily have to be as entirely of the physical and the audio. It's just that often when we're talking about that now, we're doing so under the context of visual pop culture. But there is also written pop culture that has its own sets of constructs and conceits that are perhaps not immediately visible that can queer code.
So what we might say is that when we're talking about queer coding, that we're saying the code could be all sorts of kinds of codes. It can be narrative codes, which define...
It can be semantic codes. Literally what words are being describe a piece of art. There's also a context of queer coding that is pop culture by its very nature is a dialogue, a conversation with its generation of creators, but also those who come after. So young people's reinterpretation of a piece of pop culture impacts its meaning. Its meaning is not a static thing on this
side. So I think a really good example of what you're talking about is the way in which young people are now reimagining the Lord of the Rings. Mm. And it's all over the TikToks if you're into that space. Now I love the Lord of the Rings, and ironically, he's a linguist. But the young people are like, look, they're just a gay polycule. Because they are looking at the coding of the story structure, not the way they dress, not the way they speak, but the way they're soft and supportive and intimate and close to each other. And they're like, they're picking up more on that narrative structure.
Well, there's something pretty gay about that whole aristocrat servant relationship to begin with.
I mean, there can be.
That has some like tonal components.
Well, and I think that does kind of bring up the thing that's like the reinterpretation is also from different cultures. Each culture might have a different code in which they other people and kind of bring up that otherness from the dominant culture that we kind of consider queer coding.
or taboo. Like, yeah. So don't neglect the fact that gay in particular, mm-hmm. because women were not sexual agents most of the time, so gayness was the threat in most patriarchal societies. And therefore, in many cultures, right up until recently, it is literally taboo for two men to sexually be. Like, that's taboo in the same way that sleeping with like a blood relation was taboo. There was that level of taboo around it in many cultures, not in all, but in many, and where it's not codified. And therefore, taboo becomes something that the saying that anthropologists have is that every culture has taboo, and in every culture those taboos are broken. Those are the two rules of taboo. But that means taboo also indicates fetishization in a lot of cultures, and when something becomes fetishized, it almost always immediately enters that culture's entertainment. Because it becomes something that the artists of the day usually represent as liminal creatures ourselves, but also want to have a dialogue with, because it makes people uncomfortable. If it makes people uncomfortable, we're gonna want to write about it, put it on a stage, that sort of thing. So that's and one way to safely deal with that from a purely creative standpoint is to make those characters the bad guys. Because we can have them on the stage and have a dialogue with them, but we're not actually stacked ever challenging the status quo.
We're going to punish them. So we still want to look at
them. Yes, we still want to talk about
them. I think that that's a great way to bring it back to the original part of the question, which is, of course, why connect only with queerness? Well, first of all, it wasn't necessarily done for us. It was done by other people, but in some instances, it's the only way that it could exist. So
because it's often done by us.
Yes.
Right? And maybe there's a self-hatred thing going on, but maybe it's also the only way we get represented.
Right.
It is the only way we get to represent ourselves, but also the only way we can, like, connect with other people in our community.
Yes.
Sub Rosa.
Yeah, early on. I think about back in the early days.
I'm security. Be you, man.
Yeah. But who do you find sexy? Like, there's a lot of, like, Ursula stands from like Gen X or whatever, right? There's a lot of young people who saw Disney movies and fucking fell in love with the villainy of AO3 is anything to go by. And for a lot of us, that's because that was the first, like,
exposure
safely consumed exposure we
had.
Exactly.
Is the Disney villain archetype.
Hot villain archetype.
Oh,
yes. Do you think about that added to the rise of the relatable villain? The idea of the redeemable villain that you kind of relate to, you love, that you can definitely see yourself doing the same things as.
So I think that,
No, go for it.
I think that what I would say is that the result of the relatable villain is a more of a result of something like the tragic, the tortured hero trope becoming so center stage. Like, if we're talking like
Byronic
heroes becoming sort of center stage, like, your Zukos, your, like, the very high quality people who really love that redemption arc, that is really a response to that kind of trope, which is, I think, can be tangentially related to the sort of overarching ideas, but not specifically to queerness.
I do think the AO3 and fanfic predilection for writing those villains a happy ending, or for redeeming those villains, or whatever, is possibly specifically queers being like, yes, but that was my gay. I have to give that.
I have to save him.
I have to save him.
I think the more recent kind of villains, if we're specifically picking on Disney, which why not? They have kind of
what? Who do
they don't care. Is that they have kind of taken the you want villains that are relatable? Well, now we're getting more straight.
Yeah. No, there is a real push to like straight code them in some really aggressive ways. Not sure what's trying to happen here, but I also think it's important to note that, like, I am going to say something very. We can really trace some of Disney's downturn to the loss of great queer artists that work for them.
Yes,
like the people, like when we're talking about Beauty and the Beast, and we're talking about like golden era of Disney. There's one guy who did all of that. And whose name escapes me. And
oh gosh, it was on the tip of my tongue. There's a wonderful documentary.
I think it's Howard Ashman.
It is Howard Ashman.
Yes.
Thank you. There's a fantastic documentary about his life, by the way. I highly recommend it with a box of tissues because
it's a tragic story.
Well, for those of us who are older,
and not Gen Z and Alpha, AIDS is still very much part of our story, and is certainly a part of his story. He was struck down by AIDS when he was still young and active, and I'm tearing up, I'm so ridiculous. But it's very, that's a big loss culturally, because we lost a whole generation of creators who were starting to make some cultural change through their art.
Yes.
And I think that I want to talk about some of the historical context, because there's a key, for at least for the United States and America, there's a really big social shift that created a lot of what we would describe as like the queer-coded Dylan-y experience, which is the Hays Code. We can't really talk about this without talking about the Hays Code, which is a series of codified laws that prohibited the positive representation of queer people in media, books, movies, TVs, comic books. However, it did not prohibit the demonstration of them as villains or tragedies. So it was very common for that piece of, like, people talk a lot about how early queer media is a real downer because it's so much tragedy and so much sorrow. And that leads into the 80s and 90s pretty aggressively, but that's because of a trajectory created by the Hays Code. You have a history of art to be created in a very specific way, and that trajectory is not a thing that you can easily shift.
If you want a really good example of queer coding during the Hays Code, Rope was actually very queer coded. The Hitchcock.
Oh.
You rewatch that through a queer lens, you suddenly see kind of all of the pieces fit into place of these men who actually very fiercely love each other, but they're villains. They murdered. Sorry, spoilers for a very old
I cannot guarantee this will not be a spoiler-free panel.
It's spoiler-free.
It's very spoilerful. I'm sorry.
All the spoilers.
Life happens. You can't talk about media without talking about the whole thing.
I'm gonna mention something else on the piggyback of the Hays Code, mm-hmm. which is, putting the Hays Code aside, one of my like dorkdoms is Asian dramas as well. So I'm specifically interested in the sort of history of Japanese cinema, because let's be clear, in Asia it's like the only real cinema with any voice to it that's really its own. But just in general, and one of the things that is pretty kind of understood in the dialogue of pop culture enthusiasts and analysts and critics is that there seems to be a cycle of acceptance to representation, and that is queer representation and other forms of representation, which is usually villainy, mockery, best friendery, like sidekick.
Right? Yeah, the queer best friend.
And then authentic stories. And you can see this, for example, in the history of the rom-com in the United States, right? Bad guy is queer-coded or act blatantly queer, so on and so forth. So it's just something to know, because it seems to appear in most other film dialogues and literary dialogues throughout the world. It does seem that representation has that particular pattern. Mm-hmm. Seems like the Hays Code extended ours a little bit longer than everything else about Hollywood would have let us.
And I think it did shift it to tragedy became, I mean, tragedy porn for gay media is a hefty chunk.
I'm arguing that it also happens in Japan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's happening, it happened in Taiwan. It happens in places that are going through their own cycles of acceptance. This sort of pattern. The gay tragedy, so, like, we can accept the gays if they die together, Brokeback Mountain lives forever, right?
So, like, have you noticed the commonality in, like, Japanese trauma, like, dramas about, like, that are obviously gay-coded, kamikaze girls, Nana, things like that? Were they
not
the best
not even
friend
coded.
Trope?
Nana
like,
is
it's
Yuri.
Obviously they're in love with each other, but then somehow they end up with men. And it's just, like, at the end, their happy stories are separate apart.
I mean, kind of... like with at least American Hollywood, like you would have a character who had a like two female best friends, but by the end the heteronormative romantic ending, even if they had no chemistry or maybe one or two scenes with the male like protagonist, is always how it ended.
But it's almost like in Japanese media, it's almost like they do the otherism, whereas like they're extreme opposites, the polar opposites, that if one of these characters was of the opposite gender, they would absolutely end up together. Like, it's just, they're pointed right at each other, but then somehow they end up with...
But remember, Japan loves to navel gaze, and they love to dwell. And I always call Japan the, like, emo of the film industry, right? Like, and they tend to have two lanes. They have comedic slapstick, which comes out of manga, and then they have Kurosawa, right? They have very long shots and very sweeping, right? And they'll apply those to their romances and their love stories. And so gay in this context is materially different from gay in this context. Gay in this context is tragic and doomy and villainy and all of those things. Gay in this context, in the other lane, is often the comic relief, or now Japan is giving them their happy ending.
Well,
they may not ever kiss.
There's also part of this, this is not necessarily tied to the villainy portion of this, but just to give you some additional context. In the context of some Yuri, particularly things like Nana, which don't end with them together, it's the framework is that lesbianism is something you do in adolescence.
Mm.
And
oh,
then
it's
maturing,
like growing out of it.
You grow out of it, kind of thing. Which is, like, not ideal, obviously, but, like, that's the nature of the media. It's
they do that with first love YA stories,
they do that too.
They'll do it with the heads. They're pretty, like, egalitarian. Japan is like, we'll throw a sad ending 50% of the time.
The Fatal Frame movie adaptation of video games is a similar story. Like, oh, literally the last scene is like, oh, that was nice. We've grown into adults, and then they part their separate ways. Like, it was never...
As a sort of aside to this, I am not that up to date on all of the Asian media. I'm very well known as not knowing that much about anime or manga. I love Kurosawa because I'm that bitch, to be honest.
Do I have some Japanese queer dramas for you?
I want to weep. But I'm thinking of The Handmaid, which is like Korean really, but also
That's Fingertips, though. That's a remix of a British book.
Yeah, it's a British romance.
You didn't know?
Oh, okay.
Yes. Oh my gosh.
Have you seen Tipping the Velvet?
Oh yeah.
Yes.
It's the same author.
It's a remake of Fingersmith, right?
Fingersmith. Yeah. I think Handmaid. So there is a make of Fingersmith, the original. I think Handmaid is actually a better interpretation.
There's also
a Japanese version of it, and there's recently been a Chinese one, which was heavily censored, called Flowers, or something called the Scarlet of the Flowers.
Oh, I think I saw something about that.
They had to kill that one. They had to kill in that one.
So, okay, we're going to get back on to the main plot. So, we've established like, sort of like why this happens, which is really the... As you discussed, that the only way forward is media creation. The importance of queer people in media at all is relevant to the long-term survival and acceptance
of the species
and the community. And so that means if there is no other way to exist than as villains, then we will exist as the enemy. But that does come with some downsides.
Oh, sure.
As we move into it. So this is where we're going to move into question two. What is gained for media, for queer people engaging with this type of media? What is the value that we can get? And what are the risks of long-form engagement with queers as villains?
I think we've talked about some of the gains already, which is that you get representation in a society that doesn't want to acknowledge your humanity.
Or existence, right?
You get an opportunity to let other people who are like you, who may not have access to community, know they're not alone, even if there is a sort of like, I may be a villain, but I'm not the only one. Let's have a band of villains, you know? So that, I think, is a very real upside, even though we're going to talk about why it's mixed, right?
Yeah, I also now want a drag queens team called the Rouge Gallery.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even get it, to be honest.
Yeah,
but we're talking.
This is a generalization panel. We're just talking concepts generally. So what are the risks that we can see on the
obviously,
table?
Queer is evil.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's
like,
very
that's
society
what we're then telling the world. Yeah.
Making the assumptions. The big one that
and
I...
And predatory.
The biggest one
is gay men being associated with pedophilia. Like, that's, like, probably
and the predatory lesbian.
And the predatory lesbian.
And
yeah.
the promiscuous bisexual.
And the slutty
and,
yes.
And I often think of specifically Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the films in reference to how people think that trans people are inherently violent.
Oh. Deviant. The deviantness of
deviant.
Gender.
That
is
one is one that I typically, it's like the trans killer trope.
Yep.
In
oh my god.
Which is
yeah.
forged.
Which there are so many.
And
so many.
And it's forged out of such a weird thing because none of the people who are the take that the, these killers are inspired from were in any way trans people. None of them have any, like, cause a lot of these characters are a lot of the characters, like Buffalo Bill and all these other characters, are sewn together with the concepts of other serial killers in different arrangements. But the transness is usually something that is added whole cloth. It's not based on anything. There is no statistics that suggest that trans people are in any way more dangerous.
More likely to suffer violence.
Or they're more likely to suffer violence than committed. So it is that the biggest risk is that it makes us like the targets for that kind of behavior,
yeah.
and it makes the legislation very hard.
Yeah.
Like, sure, you know that other queer people exist, but at what cost? Just kind of the
yeah,
question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which is why, when this is skipping ahead, to when pop culture begins to give queers Heartstopper and Love, Simon and shit like that. Yes, it's like Pat and like the worst kind of standard rom-com, but we have gotten to a place where it's also normalization. Like where we get the same sort of banal stories that straights get.
So nice.
And we're given a happy ending. And suddenly that is actually as close to like an honest representation you start to see in media. Just because it's normalization, just because we've gotten over a hump where queers get to be like boring.
Yeah, I think
yay!
There's been a win.
Of
like, oh, it's okay to have not perfect writing of queer characters because it shows that people are trying different things other than the same tropes.
Yes.
Over
yes.
and over again.
Yeah, and it's okay to have the queer main characters in all the different kinds of story. Because we just want to see more and more queer main characters.
Yeah.
Well,
doing other things.
I was really
than being
delighted.
The bad guy.
Oh,
no, that's okay.
I was really delighted by like the arrival of things like Fire Island, which is like
yes,
such a delightful homage to Jane Austen. We finally got our queer Jane Austen with orgies, and I love that for us as a community. You had that.
Yes.
Or, oh, I thought I put my hand. Okay, so I think there's another risk that we don't talk about that often because it's a quieter risk, and it's a lack of societal templating for how queers are expected to interact with one another in normal ways, right? When all you have are these big reactions, right?
Oh,
you have to take up all the space of a villain. Your actions have to be really big. You end up with like lesbian sheep syndrome and the useless lesbian trope of like, oh, I just don't know how to have this community that I desire, right? Like, I see myself as a part of this thing, but how do I enter it? How do I interact? What's the template for normal, acceptable behavior? And then we get these beautiful terms like found family, but people don't know how to ask for that because we don't get a template. And you have to build it from the ground up. It's hard.
I think that that's true, and I think that the villainy component actually leads into this too, because, like, we like and appreciate all sorts of parts of, like, I recently got mad at Askew to watch Drag Race for the first time recently. That's like a whole
so
conversation we started. But we did have a conversation about the challenges of and I say characters, but I really mean the performers are incredibly mean to each other. Or the edit has made it appear that they're very mean to each other.
So mean.
And I think that is a real challenge where it's like if every moment as a queer person is a dramatic moment of crisis.
Oh my gosh, would you like to chime in here? Because I was about to chime in with my own experiences with drag and burlesque scene.
So with drag and things like that, I think, and more so now because of things like Drag Race, where you have these people who they may or may not be shitty humans in real life, but editing makes them seem like shitty humans. Now, anytime anybody comes in contact with any sort of performer, we're supposed to read you. We are supposed to throw shade. Also, or you can't possibly be gay. You're not queer enough if you are not throwing shade. You are not queer enough if you are not ragging on another performer. You are not queer enough.
But that's a little bit like what we had when it was the gay best friend who like had to exist only to like support white girls' hunt for the perfect tall, dark, and handsome. Right. And it's almost like that is, like I used to call that the queer as an accessory trope. Mm. And it seems to me that drag is like turning themselves into an accessory or being edited into that space again, right? That the largesse also has to be compartmentalized in such a way that makes it safe for interacting.
Lucy, I wanted to push back slightly on that. I feel like Drag Race is turning that archetype into what is called on pop culture main character energy. Mm-hmm. And every performer thinks they have to have this same personality, same characterization, both on stage and off stage. And that creates, in my experience, rather toxic performing environments where everybody's just constantly being, and they're like, this is just how we interact. But the only reason you interact this way is because this is what media has implied you should react and not take sincerity and reaching out seriously. And I know your hand was up for a while.
Oh, I just to expand on that, that's permeated normal society as well, because I have some friends who question, like, am I queer enough? Am I gay enough because I don't act overboard? Am I enough in this community? People think I'm straight because I'm not that catty person. I don't add to this. I'm not talking crap behind people's back. And then it's just this whole idea of, like,
imposter syndrome.
Yeah, that imposter syndrome. They're even questioning themselves of, like, yeah, I obviously enjoy gay sex, but am I gay enough? And it's like, you are, but it's like, it's weird that, like, it's almost this whole idea we have this expectation of what we're supposed to act like in public, but then when we get in private settings, we don't really know what to do because you never see villain characters in that.
I think it almost becomes an expectation for all queers to have to perform a certain way, especially around cishet folks.
Yeah.
Because now cishet folks have this idealistic version of how queer people are supposed to act.
A platonic shadow.
Right. So we're supposed to be the comic relief. We're supposed to be the catty ones that are sort of, you know, ooh, girl, oh my God, did you see her shoes? Okay, sometimes yes, but it's not for someone else's benefit, which I think has sort of become the expectation at this point. Oh, you're queer? Oh my God, do that thing.
Yeah, I think that what, I think I'm gonna, to route back to the original part that you were trying to get at, I think I'm gonna try to reflect what you said previously. It's a failure of modeling. There isn't good models for queer experiences because a lot of those were lost, to be honest. And those communities so fundamentally devastated that they had to be rebuilt. And they're rebuilt over the course of decades into internet, where internet has an attention economy that is very different than the world we live in now. It's fundamentally warped how queer communities function. And I don't think that's necessarily 100% bad. There are always positives and negatives for all these things. But it's a challenge because I know that NSU and I, we're very queer people, and we try our very hardest to be upfront that we're nice and compassionate, and that's the goal and modeling that we try to present. And I think that that's the idea, is that we... That
it doesn't make for good cinema. It's that's bad for the silver screen. So you can see where Hollywood is coming from. Hollywood is like, sure, we'll go rep, but it still has to go big or go home. So I hate to say this, but to the young people out there, you have to go to the written word. That's the pop culture space that is actually getting chewy and explorative and thinking about, like, Becky Chambers or my sci-fi stuff or TJ Klune or somebody like that, who's like thinking seriously and thoughtfully about the nature of queerness under the context of a surrounding family and how that is built and how necessary the quiet, non-spectacular factors are in that. And it is the page that allows that sort of complexity of building, because that's where the patience lies.
Well, not to toot your horn too much, but I cannot resist at least a little bit, since we're talking about the big words,
but you are really good about writing in that soft, queer space. Like,
it's my ballet book.
So, most of you probably know the Parasol Protectorate series, and if you don't, please give a gift to yourself. You deserve it. You're good enough. You should read the books, all right? They're a treasure.
I 100% agree.
I would also argue that.
That was all introduction.
But you should read the Summit Solution and all of your San Francisco werewolf books because, listen, I like smut very much, and they are smutty in the best way. Very gay.
Very
gay. So soft, which is like, oh, let me help you be a happier person. Let me help you have a better life. I know I'm an alpha werewolf, but I'm just a nice boy and I'm a little cinnamon. Everybody's gonna like me. And I'm like, yes, we are. Would you like to?
You're really good at that.
It's so nice.
Well, that's because I started writing with that like soul intent.
I would also argue that Soulless actually has an interesting component where there's a lot of ways in which Alexia and Macon's relationship has got some queer codes in it.
Oh, sure.
That allow Alexia and Macon to have the relationship they have in the first place. And I think that that's
it's because they're both very othered in the Victorian society, mm-hmm. being Scottish, being half Italian,
shocking,
and a spinster on top of that. Ah! Like, all of these things are already othering them from the society, so it gives this more expanse for.
It's juicy to write in as an author characters that exist in liminal spaces between worlds, like fusion foods. Like, especially if you've been eating one kind of food or another kind of food for a really long time, you get kind of excited when it's like. And their characters that naturally exist on liminal spaces tend to be artistic types, and that also tends to be where queer resides, especially in the past. Right? There's a reason those that we know about who are open in reality who are queer tend to be artists and performers and stuff like that.
Okay.
Your next question.
So I'm going to move on to the next question. And I think we're going to pivot a little bit because we're getting a little I want to get into some more fun conversation. It's been fun, but a little heavy. So let's get a little light. So what are some queer gooey villains from which we can draw our own inspiration?
Oh, I feel like we should have had this one sent to us before.
It's just some thoughts.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You have to start since you're asking.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Give us some examples.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
I was actually, the audience might have some thoughts.
Yes, audience.
All right.
Ursula. She's already come up.
But we can expand on that. We just mentioned her.
Yes. It's okay. And you are allowed to do whatever you want. You're Lizzie Mead.
So as a bodacious lady of a certain figure and very big skirts and a middle-aged lady, I really do find Ursula particularly appealing at this stage of my life. When I had aspirations to be an ingenue, I was like, I don't know. You know, Ariel has red hair. She's so cute. Then I was like, and she's dumb. Because why is she off with that man and not going off with the crab, who's clearly more interesting? But these are better conversations. Come on, the prince is boring. But Ursula is really the most interesting character in the whole thing. She's got some, dodgy motivations, but at least she's active.
Are we going to talk about this one? So it's She-Ra and
She-Ra
versus the Power? No, come on, I'm old. It's the original She-Ra, and what was her name? Glenda?
Evelyn?
No.
It's obviously Catra, I won't go that far back because I'm too old. Let's go slightly less far back, which is going to be Xena and not Gabrielle, but Callisto.
Callisto! There we go!
They even become each other.
They sure fucking did.
No, they have kids together. She gets pregnant with magic babies.
And then, my favorite gay man ever, Hades.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
His white fucking leisure suit.
He's
so gay.
Yes.
He's so gay. You're like, what do you
mean? And I think that
no one believes it when you make puppy eyes at a girl.
So like, I'm going to reframe the question just a little bit to make it a little bit easier on us, because examples are hard, as we've discussed previously. Thinking of tropes and then putting names on it is much harder than getting names and putting tropes on them.
Yes.
What I will say is, what are some traits that we think are really attractive in villainy?
Oh, that's easy.
It's power.
And competency.
Power and competency.
Just I power.
Yeah. Style.
Style.
Competence.
Yes,
that's the best. Yes.
Honesty.
Oh, that's true. They know exactly what they want and they go after it.
They have vision.
They have vision.
Like their self-esteem is so high. Like,
yeah.
Appearing so.
And these are all things that, especially when you're coming out as queer and early in your queerness, are incredibly difficult. Like, you haven't figured out your look. You haven't figured out who you are or what you want or anything like that. And the villain is doing all of that. Great. So sexy.
Oh, clear sight and vision.
Yeah.
Literally knowing what the hell they want.
Well, also, absolute shamelessness.
Oh, yeah.
So that's like, your favorite.
I think they've overcome adversity. Which you don't necessarily see in other characters. So you see their complexity and what they've become in spite of whatever stomped on them.
You can see that there's you can see them climb out of
exactly.
And become they become the villain after they're being destroyed, right?
Exactly. Can I point out the one?
Yeah, you can do
it. The ability to show anger.
Oh.
Which so many of us are not allowed to do.
Well, yes. And I hate to presume, do you identify as a black person?
Yep.
Okay, just make sure. That is actually a real challenging thing, particularly for black women. And like having like black witchy characters. I don't remember the name of the character.
But Yzma from the Emperor's New Groove. The idea of a black woman who could be pissed off but also queer-coded.
Also,
yes.
Yeah,
those eyelashes.
And
style.
Well, and the black witch archetype that came out of Coven, whose name escapes me, of American Horror Story Coven, whose name escapes me.
Also, the craft.
The craft. Yeah, we've got some like real like angry woman energy. Is a really like the ability to be angry in an ugly way.
And validly angry over things that have actually happened.
Yeah, I always think of they always have like followers, like they always have their little people, their little group. Like
they have a family
that adores them. You know what I mean?
Minions.
Whether it's like a romantic thing or just their like little minions, they have people.
The henchmen love them.
In addition to anger, villains can show any of the negative emotions. Like,
yeah, villains can show any negative emotion. Just because I know you're in the back, so I want to make sure everyone's...
It's brave. Yeah. They can be brave.
They can be cynical. They're the ones who can see through the, you know, candy-coated status quo and see the chinks in that armor and work through it and around it, whereas the heroes are all like, everything's got to be great.
Well, and they can reject... They can reject... inconsistencies in societal coding. So like they're gonna be they can recognize and acknowledge, like they can allow for queerness because the rules don't apply to them.
But I will also say villains can also know how to adapt to a society in order to move within it without being caught. So there's that slyness, that intelligence, that ability to code switch.
Flexible identities.
Yes.
Yeah.
To be all the things they need to be in order to survive, which is very key to me.
And I do think that, like, I think you might agree with me, Gail, that as a writer, no trait is inherently without its positives or its negatives, and that any strength can be a fatal flaw, and any fatal flaw can be a massive strength, and that the difference between a hero and a villain is really context.
And one of the things writers talk about in terms of building motivation for your character, regardless of where they sit, is what is their void? What is this? And the key, of course, this is a great secret everybody who wants to write out there, that all characters have a void in them that needs to be filled. If you're writing a romance, that void's probably going to be filled by another person or persons. But the key to the void is the character also realizes they have a void. And what the character wants to fill that void is always the wrong thing. And that's how you build tension and write a story that is character driven. And all of the characters all have voids that they're trying to fill, and they're all wrong about what they think they need. And so the villain is also going to be that. They're always going to have some kind of void that they want to be filled, and they are motivated to fill that void, usually in a villainous way, right? Which is the wrong way.
And it may be that
they don't learn their lesson.
Usually. And they won't learn that there was something else.
Yeah.
And what's the villain redemption when they figure out the real
Yes. Right? And nowadays, and not Disney, but we will redeem villains pretty regularly. Disney has tried and failed at this point. Mm-hmm.
So we have about 5 minutes left. At this point, we're just going to transition to the, if you have things you want to say before we end the session, please raise your hand. We're going to start over here because you've got some time, if that's okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm a writer, and I'm actively looking for resources to help portray queerness in the correct way in my writing, because I myself am not. So I want to, like, my main characters are, but I still want to have side characters that aren't
shallow?
Yeah, like, not even that, just I'm doing it in a correct way.
So,
and so that it like,
correct way.
Yeah.
I like the phrase that I would get away from, but I'm not a writer. I'm just
there's a resource called Writing the Other, which I would point you towards, that has multiple different ways of, so they offer different courses and have different resources for talking about different kinds of queerness in a way that is not offensive to that the participants of the members of that community.
Sensitivity reading
always, but key for me is just know which kind of, I don't know which kind of journey you're on in terms of what genres you're writing or whatever, but does it tend to be group motivated, found family with happy endings or not?
No.
Okay, then that's a hero's journey. In that particular instance, then you need to have you need to have your queer characters present in multiples, so no tokenism, so more than one. And you need to have them have powerful capacities, so they need to demonstrate competency outside of being queer. And then you need to have them as power players in the narrative, whether you kill them or not, so long as they're power players, which means information and non-betrayers. A hero's journey is going to require betrayal, because the hero gets motivation from being continually isolated. But if you're going to remove a queer support character from a hero's journey, don't make them the betrayer. So those are some key ways to make sure that you don't accidentally code them incorrectly. But I would point you at writing.
I'd also make sure, this is my personal preference, if you do multiples, if it's two, you can't just make them together. Yeah, you want to have enough that it's like, if they're a pair, they're one now. You pair them together, you lose one point.
And if I may add an addendum to this, as a reader and reviewer of fiction, Gail gave you great advice, Ops, but my advice to you is, do you know queer people?
Yeah.
Do you have friends who are queer? If you are going to write about us, I need you to know us.
Yeah.
I need you to... We're here, we're happy to talk to you. There are lots of queer people in this room right now. You don't have to befriend us all, but it's important to actually know the community and maybe engage with that community in a friendly, ally showing up kind of way, so that you get a sense of what we're like. Because it's a lot easier to be compassionate if you're like, well, I want to do this thing, but I haven't really connected with these people.
The other thing to do is just to have queer characters where the queerness maybe doesn't even come up. You just know that they're queer, and so I'm almost all of my books have trans characters in it, but I always use appropriate pronouns for those characters, so in some cases you never know, or there's maybe one line that reveals that character is trans, and like five of my fans will pick up on it and get really, really excited, but it was for them, right? Like, and that's
say it's like similar to like the Alien story, the movie Alien, when originally Ripley was written as a man and they just changed all the he's to she's, and the character still works. So if the character is strong and a fully formed person, the queerness doesn't have to be their sole trait, right? So similar kind of vibes there.
One last thing on this before we move on to something else. One thing I would also ask you to think about is first move away from correctness. What you're trying to do is be respectful to the experience of others and be more accurate to that experience. But the other part I would say is ask yourself why you want queer characters in the first place. If the goal is I just want them, get more context on what you actually are wanting out of that experience. I think it's great to have queer characters in media. I would recommend that you do so, but do so from a place of you're not just trying to market. I think that that's the more ethical way to approach it.
They will know if you are trying to.
Hands, anyone else with ideas or questions or things?
Just when you were talking about redeemable characters that actually have storylines after being villains, like one of my favorite examples of that is Dragon Ball. Because there's so many characters in it that are in fact queer-coded that started off evil, most notably Vegeta. Vegeta is in love with Goku.
Yeah, Vegeta's a weird character.
He's in love with Goku. That's weird. That's
I mean, when you're talking about a character whose romance is revealed in a single scene in which she's already pregnant and you didn't know they were dating, it's a pretty weird transition. It does send some signals. But we are about to be done. We're about 5 minutes out, so we're going to make time for cake decorating and seeing
that. Yeah.
There's a gay wedding happening this evening, so you've always got that opportunity.
There's lots of gay decorating. And here, they're decorating the cakes because there's a lot of freaking cakes and they need sugar on top.
Once more, everybody, if you want bookmarks, come get bookmarks from me. And if you're super excited about the Harrowman journey, I have one copy with me. And I'm happy to give it to somebody who has his not blind carry on. Never mind.
So sorry.
Perks have made out of bounds.
I ordered this and a bunch of other books on thrift books, and yes. I accidentally forgot to update my address. So I had moved across the country, and somebody did not return them or did not send them back. Maybe so if somebody has your book in back in California, so
I really want to thank everyone for being here and letting us share chatter.
Yes, thank you for your questions.
Thank you to my fellow panelists.
Thank you for and thank you for your wonderful
comments. He's going to have to call his panel cherry. This is his first panel.
Oh my gosh, welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Creative Playin' Podcast Network. If you enjoyed our show, please check out D&D Journey of the 5th Edition and Ragnarok Enroll a Scion Hero to Ragnarok Story. Also, check out our Patreon page for more content and behind-the-scenes things, as well as joining us for a one-shot game or two.